aristocracy in Judaism. I don't mean aristocracy in the sense of blue blood, but I mean aristocracy. No Jew can say what happened to X cannot happen to me. This is a mistake, gentlemen. I resent very much when Zionist leaders of the time, Ben Gurion, begins to tell us how unreliable the diaspora is. And I don't say the diaspora is very reliable. I don't say. But I say something else. If the diaspora is not reliable, so is Israel. If, I must use the Hebrew expression, chas v'shalom, the day should come on which the American government and the American people should turn anti-Semitic and begin to pass anti-Jewish legislation and engage in a campaign of religious persecution or minority persecution, then, of course, we have no shelter here, but we won't have any shelter in Israel. Ridiculous. Many times, not him personally, because I never met him, but the Zionist leaders, it is crazy because it's nonsensical. Because the security in Israel's safety depends upon the American, the Western society. If well, not only the United States, for the United States is the leading country, but the Western society should go anti-Semitic, and there is no safety in Israel. On the contrary, I believe there will be more safety in America even. Even in an anti-Semitic America than Israel, with Nasser on the one hand and Qassim on the other hand. It's ridiculous. So it's not the prophecy of doom. But however, there is no security. We call the human being has no security, I always say. But this American ideal that a man can find security is false. A man has no security as an individual, as I said many times. And if I have a big bank account, so am I secure? I'm not secure because the vicissitudes of life are not only in the economic area. Today I can move my fingers, next day I cannot move my fingers. What can I do? Is this security? Who can secure me against a heart attack or a shock or a paralytic shock? Who can secure me? It's ridiculous when people speak about security. There's no security. And the Jew, to say I am secure and that's all, is ridiculous. I say it for many reasons, gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I say it because this is the sense. It's not, first of all, this is the prevailing mood in Judaism. But it's not pessimism, understand? It's not pessimism. It's like a Jew. A Jew is never secure as a person. On the other hand, a Jew is an optimist. It's a combination. They all say the Jew thinks in dialectical terms. The thesis is right, but the antithesis is also right. The thesis is right, no one is secure. The antithesis is also right. A man should feel secure as far as possible. But there is, you see, if you operate with the thesis and antithesis, you understand? It's a dialectical thinking. You don't operate with ultimates. Either this or that, no. So then it's a different, you develop a different approach. I am saying that for two reasons. I told you many, my interpretation of Judaism is not objective. There's no person who interprets Judaism can be objective. Judaism is an experience. And experiences vary as personalities vary. Of course, my interpretation of Judaism is an outgrowth of my own personality, my own experiences. I lived for many years in Germany. The good years. The seven good years, we say it in biblical language, when Germany was ruled by social democracy in the 20s. And then the German Jew, of course, in Poland, we used to have in Poland and the Lithuanian used to have anti-Semitic violence and outbreaks from time to time. So German Jews, assimilated Jews, I mean, all German Jews were assimilated, whether they were pious or not pious, but they were assimilated. And don't forget, the German society, Jewish society, was integrated into the German society by far more than the American Jewish society is integrated in the American society, because integration is a problem of years. It's not a question which you can bring it about by changing the language. It's a question of morals and the way of thinking. And don't forget that the German Jewish society was as old almost as the German civilized society. You tell me, what happened in Poland cannot happen here. It's impossible. And of course, I mean, Hitler was on the scene a little bit, but of course he was more a comical figure in 1926, 1927, 1925. He was a comical figure. No one paid serious attention to him. A crackpot from Vienna who didn't speak a decent German. He spoke a grammatically wrong, faulty German. It's a fact. He never learned how to speak German properly. You know, even when he was the leader, the Führer of the German people, it cannot happen yet. And I always felt a certain sense of complacency. Complacency and security. That's exactly it happened. it could have happened in Germany and Germany, and then to say it is that Germany is different from all nations, it's ridiculous. The Germans, although I knew many Germans, good Germans and bad Germans, very cultured people, you know, so as far as culture is concerned, they are second to none. I mean, far philosophy, metaphysics and this. And who wrote beautiful books about ethics, if not the German people? I mean, the categorical imperative, I mean, so a man should sacrifice himself for the categorical imperative, and so forth. That even the Notlüge, I mean, the necessary lie, one shouldn't say even necessary lie to save his life. Who did it? Who said it, if not Fichte, I mean, the famous German philosopher? But still, why is it? Because human beings can be either devils or angels. And we are all human beings. I'm not sure that even in Israel, Hitler can, is impossible. Even Israel is possible. We are also human beings. With all our charismatic endowment, we are still human beings. And a human being is not reliable, that's all. You know what David says, all men are liars. It's correct, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't trust men, but you should always remember that.
Trust me, watch
it. Watch out, yes. You know that the Talmudic expression, kabdeyu vechashdeyu. Pay him respect, but watch out.
No wonder you can't be secure.
And not so much for pickpockets in this regard. And vicissitudes of life. And there are biological vicissitudes, and there are also historical vicissitudes. At certain periods, a nation might go crazy. Might run amok, a nation. Not all individual. We saw it with Germany. Now Germans are a sober people again. All right, you have some anti-Semites, I mean crackpots, doesn't mean anything. And we have crackpots here too, so who cares about it? But the Jewish history wants the solidarity of hate. Yes, disaster for one community, Judaism said, even though distant from and strange to the other community, must alarm and summon to defensive action all Jewish communities. If one community finds itself in trouble.
Can we interrupt at this point?
Yeah.
Because there's a contradiction here of the statement, this is one world, but one world for Jews only, apparently, because certainly in our practice, again, perhaps it's not true generally, but in America here, our practice around different religions, around different color, around different practices, even among some of us Jews, doesn't testify to an observance of this one world for others.
Basically, Jews. I'll tell you, basically, I'm speaking now about one world for Jews, one destiny, I wouldn't say
well,
one
that's
world.
What I'm
but basically, later I'll show you that what Judaism demands parochially from the Jew, see within the Jewish community, it also, I mean, demanded from the Jew universally. That the Jew shouldn't consider himself a part of humanity, and also consider that the common destiny of humanity is one. But we start as Jews, and we climb up little by little to the another level, the universal level. And that's exactly, it is correct. But whether American Jews have it or not, it's hard for me to say, I believe they have it, I'll speak about it. I believe I was wondering whether American Jews have this experience of the covenant of Im, whether they have it or not. I was wondering many times, and I arrived at many at different conclusions at many times, at various times, but the final conclusion is, as I grow older, I mean, either I become wiser or poor, more foolish, I don't know, but I am more convinced that American Jew has this feeling for the covenant. Whether he spells it out or not is a different story. American Jews feels a lot and doesn't dare to say many things. There is a lot he feels, intuitively knows a lot, American Jew. Somehow there's an inner fear about American Jew to spell out. What if
you're saying philosophically, then we have.
I would say even that philosophy. I mean, each American Jew feels himself a part of the general Jewish community, not only the American Jewish community, but the general Jewish community. I don't, because it is so. But the American Jew, I know many American fathers are afraid to tell their children what they feel. What they feel about themselves somehow. I don't know, there's a certain reluctance about the American Jew to say what he is, what he stands for. Many times it's hide and seek, I mean, game, I mean, play the American Jew. But let me continue. Because this is just the first aspect. All Jewish community, not because of sympathy you must help them, and pity, but for the distinct feeling of involvement of the Jew with the fate of the other Jew. regardless of the endless distance, geographically, culturally, and politically, separating one Jew from another. If a Jew tries to desert his people and to flee the common destiny to which he was committed, he is dragged back by a cruel and cynical fate. I feel impelled to refer you again to the story of Jonah, which is impregnated with symbolism, how he is dragged back to God, whom he tried to flee and to desert. Interesting is the story in the Bible. Moses, before he was elected to become the Redeemer of the Jewish people, had to go through a funny experience. Moses, the prince, the darling of Pharaoh, leaves the royal palace and walks out and goes out to his brother and witnesses a very paradoxical, episode. An Egyptian taskmaster smiting a Hebrew slave, one of his brother. See, basically, if you take a look at Exodus, the Bible is very terse, but one word conveys the idea. If you take Exodus 2, verse 11, Exodus 2, chapter 2, verse 11, and it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown up, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens. What kind of brethren were they to him? What kind of brothers were they to him? He was not raised in the ghetto, Moses, according to the biblical story. He was raised in the royal palace. What kind of brothers were they to him? And what impelled Moses to leave the premises of comfort and luxury, of oriental comfort and luxury, and go, to the slave camp, to the concentration camp, and witness, so to say, the travail and the pain and suffering of some strangers, of some Hebrews, whom he didn't know, as a matter of fact. What impelled him? I don't know what impelled him, but if you'd ask me, some inner force, a compulsive force, something impelled him. And brethren, and he looked on their burdens. What does it mean, he looked on their burdens? What do you mean, he looked on their burdens? That means he looked on their burdens. Oh, it's not a question of looking. I mean, he experienced their burdens. Of course, the Bible didn't have the expression experience. Looking means participating, sharing the burdens. And what did he see? Vayarish mitzri makei shivri mecha. And he saw an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brothers. And what Moses did, he defended it. What does it show? That before the Redeemer, Moses was elected as Redeemer and leader, he had to do one thing, identify himself with the people. If he hadn't identified himself with the people, he could have never been elected the Messiah of Israel. Messiah of Israel does not come from the aristocracy, does not come from the above, from the higher strata. He comes from out of the midst of the crowd. And the crowd was in the ghetto. Moses had to identify himself. Moses culturally, psychologically, he was a different person. He was an Egyptian. You see, when he came to Midian and he helped the daughters of Yethro, and they came home and the father asked them, why did you come home so quickly? So he said, Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian, helped us. So he looked like an Egyptian. Moses was completely assimilated, apparently, at that time. He was reared in the palace of Pharaoh. What dragged him, to the Jews, to the poor, dirty Jews in the slaves, in the ghetto in Goshen? What dragged him? I don't know what dragged him. The covenant hasn't been established yet, but apparently what was to be established later, Moses already experienced intuitively before. Dragged him, the feeling of common destiny, identification.
While in the palace, wasn't Moses aware of the
Jews? He was aware of the
stories of his mother?
Yes, stories of the mother, correct, when she nursed him. But don't forget, nursing basically, Mother nursed him. Basically, as much as you know now, we can know pretty well about it with Talmudic sources. The nursing period, I mean, she was nursed by the breast, probably, took about 24 months. So it means, and then said that the mother brought him back to Pharaoh after completing the period of nursing. So, I mean, Moses, when he came out, a two-year-old child, was returned back, he was returned to the palace. I don't believe he had any memories of his mother. And let us assume that his mother was in touch with him. Although I cannot imagine whether it was possible or not. Because the difference between the king of Egypt and a poor Hebrew woman, a slave, I don't know, there could be much intercourse, I mean, between the palace and the ghetto. So, but he was reared in Egyptian culture. What dragged him out of them? I don't know. It's hard to say. We just have fragments. But this is apparently the covenant. Interesting is Maimonides, in enumerating those to whom a share in the hereafter, in the future world, who will be denied because of grave offenses, writes of the Jew, who is indifferent to the suffering and the travail of his people as follows. I am quoting him verbatim, but of course I translate into English, and if you want to have the source, I can give you. The laws pertaining to conversion, Tshuva, chapter 3, paragraph 20. One who separates himself from the community, he will never share the bliss of the world to come. This is, in Judaism, it is the severest punishment. Even if he does not commit a transgression, and even if he is pious, observes all laws of the Torah, only holds himself aloof from the congregation, of Israel, does not fulfill religious precepts in common with his people. He fulfills all religious precepts, but not in common with his people. Shows himself indifferent when they are in distress. Does not observe their fasts. A fast is an expression of solidarity, an expression of sympathy with the persecuted, but goes his own way as if he were one of the Gentiles and did not belong to the Jewish people. Such a person has no portion in the world. It's interesting, even an Orthodox Jew, even a fanatic belonging to the lunatic French, I don't care how Orthodox he is, if you let this covenantal experience of togetherness in historic, with regard to historical destiny, is not considered a good Jew. Now, this sharing of interest, community of interest, leads to something else. Community of feeling, emotional involvement. The community It means he should not only, so to say, keep intellectually, see himself a part of the Jewish community, but simply experience both at the passional and eudaimonic level all the pleasure, all the travail, pain, sufferings, and distress of other parts of the community. Compassion or co-suffering with others is basic in our commitment. The experience of the Jew, whether tragic or joyful, must be keenly shared and perceived, entered into and shared by all. To suffer with the oppressed and rejoice with the free is a part of our commitment. This is, first, it was an intellectual level, to consider himself a part of the community. Not to think that I can escape. I am different because I'm more cultured, I'm richer, I'm more prominent. What happened to the poor Jew cannot happen to me. Secondly, I should simply feel it. This commitment should not only be thought out in intellectual terms, but felt. But here we come to the third and perhaps the most important aspect of this common destiny knowledge and experience. This is a community of responsibilities. It's very important. We must stress time and again this community. This awareness of community of interests and experiences leads to a community, to a third community, of responsibilities. And community of responsibilities, again, can be seen at two levels. First of all, we are morally accountable for each other. This is the Judaic concept. All Israel are Revim Zalazeh. All Jews are morally accountable, answerable, before the Almighty for the effort, for the errors of their fellow men or their fellow brothers. We must answer for the conduct of our brother to a degree that no other national group experienced it. Basically, I'm not speaking now from a logic viewpoint, from a historical viewpoint. Somehow I don't know why it is so. Why it is so, I don't know. I cannot explain it. Perhaps it is due to some anomalous thinking on the part of the Gentile world, but it is a fact that the world places upon us collective liability and answerability. It is a historical paradox, yet the paradoxality does not diminish our togetherness in the eyes of the non-Jewish society with regard to our moral responsibility. This is the most important thing. Let me illustrate this paradox with an example from current events. We all know too well, and I happen to know it very well, because I went through it, what the name Marx, or the name Trotsky, or Zinoviev, meant to the anti-Semitic bigot. That's what I want to emphasize. There are certain questions, for instance, I'll give you an example with Israel. We know that some Gentiles attack us for double loyalties, for divided loyalties, for divided commitments with regard to Israel. And I must tell you, I myself am a member of the Zionist Party, the religious Zionist wing. But it is a problem for the American Jew. It's not like people in the Theodor Herzl Institute want to do away with this problem. It's a problem. It's got to be thought out properly. And if the question is posed to us, and it's posed to me very often, we should know what answer. What's about the Catholic? There's no answer about the Catholic. But the Catholic is not as committed to Ireland as we are committed to Israel. There's one difference. And if you think we know that, I can tell you that the intelligent Gentiles know it well. See. But what troubles me is not some literature published by Herbert Gerald Smith. This is a correct part. What troubles me is that decent Gentiles, people who have no prejudice against the Jews, keep on asking me the same question. When I meet them. The same question. So apparently, you see, the person who is somehow the hateful person says it aloud. The person who is not hateful, a normal person, who is understanding, the intelligent Gentile, asks a question. And if the question is asked, never try to put the question the way it's best. But try to answer. It's a different problem. I'll perhaps analyze this problem. We should know this problem, how to encounter if we are challenged. Yeah. But even with communism, it raises questions in the minds of the Gentiles. Even a decent non-Jew remarked to me the other day, when he read about the arrest of a Jew as a communist spy, agitator, of course, it's very bad. But he said, it seems to me, of course, he's a sociologist by profession, so he can afford the luxury of speaking in impersonal terms. Science is also a license for sin, you see. It's very well to be a scientist, you can do anything you want, as religion sometimes is a license for sin. So it seems to me, certainly very nicely, very swelly, as if the Jew willingly sympathizes with these revolutionary ideas, and it's of course due to their historical experiences, he said to me. Of course, it's not an indictment of the Jew, never mind indictment or no indictment, but he said it to me. Historical experience. Somehow, because the Jew is questing for justice, for equality, he thinks that he can find justice and equality in a communist order. That's what he told me. Very nicely phrased. I cannot say anything against it. So, all right. But it means the problem bothers him. Why is it? It's a sense of collective responsibility. On the other hand, however, gentlemen, None. Not even the craziest person. Someone, an inmate of Bellevue Hospital, who will blame the Chinese in America, or even the Chinese on Formosa, from Mao Zedong and Chulin, and the powerful communization of Asia, carried out by the Chinese people. Imagine, gentlemen, if Israel would go communist. Imagine. And it's also possible. Everything is possible to me. Israel went communist. Imagine our luck here. You know what we... I don't know what we... I don't know what we... What the world would say to us. And Israel... A communist Israel would not be dangerous to society. Who cares? Two more million people communist. Poor. Actually, people without security, safety. And here is a great empire of 600 million people communist. No one is blaming a Chinese man in America for simple reason. I mean, why the Chinese in America, either an American resident or an American citizen, he's not to be blamed for Mao Zedong, of course. Collective responsibility is a primitive way of thinking. This is a scapegoat psychology, to put all these things on the scapegoat, on this innocent goat. Yes, but somehow it works with regard to us. I don't know why it is so. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an anthropologist. It's hard for me to explain, but it's a fact. Yes, Mr.
Zagorny. I'm worried about it this way. Take the case of a communist. And how many countries have communists been active in revolution other than in China itself?
You mean who, the Chinaman? Over all Asia. You know, China now is the greatest danger. Russia is no danger now. China is communist. There is a communization of Asia. We didn't lose the war, the Cold War in Europe, or you lost the Cold War in Asia, because there is steady communization of Asia. And you'll see, I don't want to be a prophet of doom. I'm afraid that Asia will go communist, including India. Because there's no force which can resist communism in Asia. And still no one blames the China.
The fact is that historically so far, people have attributed Jews with liberalism, with radicalism, and I think historically it has been true.
How many Jews were active in the liberal movement? I happen to know very well the Russian history. How many Jews here and there, during the revolution there were a few Jews, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky, all right, but there are more Russians. I mean, there is something which I cannot understand, yes.
Well, isn't there a story, maybe it's apocryphal, about your own father with relation to a Russian Jewish revolutionary?
About my grandfather, yes.
Is that true?
No, it's true, true story.
Right. Well, there is an example of the...
No, this is nothing to do. You know the story about my grandfather, with the rabbi in Brie, the famous of time. The once revolutionary of the social revolutionaries, I mean, they believed in terror. Social democracy in Russia did not believe in terror. They thought to bring it about by, say, by... through an educational campaign in terror. So when the governor general of Warsaw, the district of Poland, that time was a part of Russia, was killed by a bomb, a boy from Brisk, from the town he was rabbi, was involved. And of course it meant the court martial and death. My grandfather, whether he didn't believe in his guilt, or he believed in his guilt, but he thought still on him for killing the governor general in Warsaw, a Jewish boy should not die on the gallows. Anyway, what his opinion was, I don't know, I can tell you that. So he got the news about it. It was Erev Yom Kippur, before he went to shul. This is true. So, and he knew in Russia, I mean, bribes worked wonders. Still a good, what wonders of Russia. I mean, the Jews couldn't survive, I mean, all the persecution in Russia, you didn't have this magical, how to say, fantasy of bribing the officials. So he thought that if he'll bribe the Ispravnik, Ispravnik was the head of police, and the Spavnik will give testimony about the character of the boy. The boy was a nice boy, he might have been involved in that. So he'll save the boy. The trial was to take place, I mean, you keep a morning in Warsaw. Right? It's a night, it's about 7 hours travel, at time, 7-8 hours travel. So, but you needed at least 10,000 rubles. 10,000 rubles at the time was a lot of money. It was 1906. So he closed all schools in Kippur. You know what in Kippur Eve meant in Brisk 50 years ago. So he closed all schools. He opened only one shul, the so-called the cold shul, the big shul. And he told all Jews of Brisk to come to that shul. No one knew for what. For what purpose? All schools in Brisk, there were about 25 or 30 schools, tremendous community. All schools were closed. All Jews had to stream to that shul. he came to that shul for Kalvidra, you know, for the service. Everything was ready, and he went up and pulpit. And I said, gentlemen, I want you to go home. Open your safes, not safes, your drawers. Take all the money you need. You have. Bring the money to shul. We would not take Kalvidra tonight. We'll collect money. I mean, the people thought that the rabbi is out of his mind. He was out of his mind. I mean, you know what it meant 50 years ago in Brisk, in Kippur-Kalira, tell people to go home and handle money and carry money. It's a true story. I mean, I'm not adding one word. I mean, I don't know how you know about it. How did you get...
My father-in-law.
I thought my father was present there. So, and he and the members of the rabbinate of Brisk, was a great community, went up the platform, instead of saying Kalvidra, everybody, but since the rabbi said, I mean, it's in order, I mean, the rabbi is crazy in his right senses, so it's a different problem, but in order, even from a crazy rabbi, is in order. So it was carried out, and the people began to bring money. So in no time, the amount of $10,000 was raised. So instead of saying Kalvidra, he told the people to wait with the service, and he, with a group of prominent laymen of the community, went to the so-called Spravnik, the police commissioner of this, and they talked to him, and they gave him, I don't know how they gave him, this is a different story, skillfully gave him the money, and the Spravnik, the commissioner of police, asked my grandfather to sign an affidavit on behalf of his boy, to sign Yom Kippur an affidavit, you know, the night of Yom Kippur. My father signed affidavit, right, my grandfather signed affidavit right away. The Spravnik took the train the same night. He came to Warsaw morning to the trial, and as police commissioner, as a Russian police commissioner, he testified that he's convinced in the innocence of the boy, and he was acquitted. Yeah, what does it show? It shows all the greatness and part of my grandfather, yes. I mean, I'll come and I'll speak about loving kindness, Dhaka. I have many stories like that. But what does it show? I mean, with regard to that.
But even in that instance, though...
He felt collectively responsible, of course. It's collective responsibility. Collective responsibility, of course. Collective responsibility. It's not only that he felt if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would be shared by the community, but there were two reasons. First of all, the sharing of, because if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would have been shared by the community. Secondly, simply an act of mercy and sympathy and compassion to the boy. That's right. Yes. And it actually, I mean, the idea of collective moral accountability is mentioned in the Bible. You know, I'm a rabbi, I go back to the Bible. Is mentioned in the Bible. If you open the Bible, Numbers 16, just a moment. Yes, number 16, verse 22. Verse 21, 22. Number 16, verse 20, 21, 22. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, separate yourself from the among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They sinned. It was a story with Korah. And they fell upon their faces and said, for God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation? It was a question mark. Oish echad yechate, one man sin, and your wrath will avenge itself upon the whole congregation? It's a question mark, and God did not say no. Apparently it's a fact. It's more a rhetorical question. This is already collective responsibility. One was involved, the community paid the price. Then, of course, the Jewish law, yes, just a minute, the Jewish law of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh, every Jew halakhically is responsible for the commitments of his other fellow man. Yes. And what you, I'm asking, Doctor.
I want to ask you a basic question on an idea. This charisma, this idea of covenant.
Yes.
And it's an experience.
Sure.
From childhood on.
It's implanted, yes.
Implanted. Now, do you think there's any possibility of transmitting it to young adults?
I'll tell you, Dr. Eisenberg, you as an educator is interested in this problem. I'm also interested. We'll come to this problem, how practically to develop that. But let us limit ourselves now to theory. Of course, I know you're interested in that, as an educator. Yeah, this is the idea of collective responsibility for individual culpability. It reflects unfavorably upon the community as such. They may be blamed for the errors of the one. They share the blame, which logically should be confined to the evildoer. It's a strange form of ethical solidarity comes to the fore. That is why our sages said, and it's important for modern Jews very much, that the Jew involved in a public scandal, or in any transgression, or in any indecent deed, or something, and not even this particular deed is morally culpable, morally or juridically culpable, when there is no element of culpability. You know, there are many things you do, we are on the line, as we say it, of course, on the line, you know. But many things we do, I told once a lawyer in Boston, he says he's on the line. He says, yes, on the line, but you can do many things which are, although, I mean, you can put one in jail for that, but they are very, I wouldn't even say they're immoral. They're even more, judged by formal standards, they are moral too. But it's still, I don't know how to, I didn't know any adjective how to describe it, but it don't belong into, a Jew should not practice that. Something one is vulgar. Vulgarity is not immoral, no? I mean, there's no injunction against vulgarity. There's no injunction against bad manners. One can display bad manners in the streetcar or in a restaurant or on the street. I mean, there is no moral norm against exhibitionism. When Jews begin to exhibit their wealth or whatever they are, whatever they have, they possess, and their paintings or their jewelry or their mink coats. I mean, of course, mink coats are only women. I mean, men, I don't know what men exhibit. Oh, and there's something else. I mean, there is no moral law, but it's vulgar. Is even anything public in public vulgar act or insolence, arrogance, the part of the Jew? Oh, even though no moral wrong had been committed, if the Jew had perpetrated a double crime. First of all, if the act is culpable, it's bad in itself. And secondly, the crime reflects unfavorably upon the Jewish community. That's exactly what we call in the halacha, Chilul Hashem. And on the contrary, if a Jew reflects credit upon the Jewish community, that's what we call Kiddush Hashem. It's a central norm. If you'll open the books, you'll find this norm. It is Leviticus. It is Leviticus 60. Leviticus 22. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And ye shall keep my commandments. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name. But I will be hallowed or sanctified among the children of Israel. How can one sanctify God? By not reflecting discredit upon the Jewish community. Because God and the community are one.
This kind of interdependence, or this extreme form of interdependence, can also breed a great deal of intolerance. Because if your life is so interdependent on other people, and you share in this kind of responsibility...
You are right. There is an element of risk there. You are right. But about tolerance, there is a different problem. I'll come to tolerance yet. But there is a... basically, I mean, we don't preach. We try to educate. I mean, of course, there is an element, because I am personally involved. So I get angry. For instance, there are, within the Jewish society, you'll take, for instance, certain groups, I don't want to mention names, who are more on the fringe. I mean, on the fringe, they are easily scared by a public scandal about a Jew. So they sometimes engage in certain absurd, I would say, campaigns, which actually, I mean, are not constructive. But let's first, I mean, just describe it. And Maimonides says, and I'm ready with this, there are other things that are a profanation of the name of God. See, Maimonides says it. I'm quoting. when a man does things which cause people to talk about him, even if the acts are not do not express violations, he profanes the name of the God. That's for example, if a person makes a purchase and does not pay promptly, provided that he has the means and the creditors ask for the payment, he need put them off. But there is no moral culpability in that. Or if he indulges immoderately in jesting, eating or drinking, or when his mode of addressing people is not gentle, or he does not receive people affably, but he is quarrelsome and irritable. The greater the man is, the more scrupulous should he be in all such things, and do more than the strict letter of the law requires. If a man has been scrupulous in his conduct, gentle in his conversation, pleasant toward his fellow man, affable in manner when receiving them, not retorting even when affronted, but showing courtesy to all, conducting his commercial affairs with integrity, devoting himself to the study of the Torah and doing more than his duty in all things, avoiding extremes and exaggerations, such a man has sanctified God. And concerning him, the scripture says, "And he said unto me, Thou art my servant to Israel, in whom I take pride, and by whom I am glorified." This is my Maimonides. This is collective responsibility, gentlemen. If you want the source, I can give you. It is Deoth, D-E-O-T-H, 49, column 3. 49, chapter 49, paragraph 3. Yuchot, yes, yes. In a word, a Jew must always be conscious of his moral responsibility toward his fellow man. Fellow Jew, the guilt of an individual is also shared collectively, and others are accountable for his deeds, which reflect either credit or disgrace upon his people. This is moral togetherness, and this is very important. This is him together. But responsibility expresses itself in something else. And here I come to the concept of tzedakah. This is the moral covenant. Yes, sir.
I'd like to raise a question as to how do we account for the Jew espousing unpopular causes? Forgetting about the elements.
What do you call unpopular causes? Sometimes unpopular causes are a very good cause.
Yes, but I mean, if the concern is that a Jew reflect
yes.
The concern of the community, the Jewish community.
Yes.
This one individual.
I'll tell you frankly, it does not mean that I have to follow the line laid down by the daily news and the daily mirror.
Like
they say. I don't hear that. Oh no. I spoke about the prophetic law. We'll come to concepts of social justice later. What the covenant requires of us in our dealings with the outside society. Oh no. Oh no. A Jew, Abraham was one Jew. I mean, the whole world was against him. But what's objectively wrong? I'm not speaking of it. There is a criterion here. I'll give you an example. I had a case during this McCarthy period, this crazy McCarthy period. Some teacher, he was a teacher of French in a high school here. He was a student at the Yeshiva University. So he was called before the Un-American Committee, the State Committee, and un-American activities, I mean, of course, and the chairman of the American, the chairman of the State Education Committee is a Jew now, Silver, who is in servitude to the, I may say publicly in servitude to the Archbishop of the Spellman, you see, he does what Spellman wants him to do, you see, and I know I had my experience with him. So he was called, of course, McCarthy, I mean, he was a communist discovered in the 30s, and when I'll come to the concept of tshuva, of conversion, repentance, so McCarthy did not have the concept of tshuva. Anyway, and they wanted him to disclose the names of his associates, and they were teachers, actually are teachers in the public school system. So instead of quoting the Fifth Amendment, which is the usual procedure, he said that the Jewish law prohibits squealing informally. And he is a Jew who is committed to a set of moral principles, and he cannot violate them. So the American Jewish Committee got scared. They are easily scared, the American Jewish Committee. So I don't want to tell you the names, or the attorney of the American Jewish Committee called me, it's a public scandal. Not the public scandal. So he told me to start. The whole Jewish community is involved. You know what the paper will come out, Judaism protects, Jewish religion protects communism. So I said to him, I'll tell you, Mr. So-and-so, listen, You want me to give you an answer? I'll give it in writing, and I don't care if this answer will be published in the press. You just address your inquiry to the Law Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America, for which I am the chairman, and then it will be my duty on me to answer. If no official inquiry is addressed to me, I'm not supposed to answer. So a letter came in, as a matter came in from the chairman of the commission. I don't remember his name now, a gentle fellow. And then it was turned over to me, and he had a fight at the Rabbinical Council of America. Most rabbis said, we cannot now, in such a climate of prejudice and hatred and bigotry, we cannot defend an individual who does not want to disclose the names of his associates. And you saw, I mean, it's very easy to become patriotic and employ, I mean, pseudo-patriotism. They are a menace to society. A menace to society. The man teaches French, the menace to society. And the other teacher about whom he was supposed to school taught physics, you see, a menace to society. And he quit the Communist Party in the 30s. So this was in the 40s. What about 1950 or 1951? I don't remember exactly. My memory doesn't remember. So finally I wrote a brief. They never published this brief. And I said, I prohibit, he's a member of the Rabbinical Council, and we made him a member of the Rabbinical Council of America. He joined, I mean, a few months ago, whether he joined it because he knew it's coming up, I don't know. He was actually ordained. And he's a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, and he's subject to decisions of the Law Commission. I prohibit, I enjoin him on my decision from disclosing any names. And then they asked, and then I said why. Because first of all, squealing is prohibited. We have to inform the authorities if the person in question is a public menace. But however, I don't see any public menace. Even if an associate who teaches physics or chemistry or biochemistry, I mean, was a member of the Communist Party 10 years before, and quit because he didn't like their policies, because he simply has contempt for them now. And then the trouble is with all these inquiries that you don't know a basic law in the Bible, the law of repentance. A man can sin and come back to God. And that's why I don't dare tell him, I mean, to inform. And they took the letter, and he was not cited for contempt. He was not cited for contempt. The letter was not published by anybody. I don't know where it is now, if I want to find their file somewhere. I mean, I don't say that, but I mean culpability at a higher level. Now, collective responsibility, gentlemen, manifests itself also at the level of tzedakah. What is the idea of tzedakah? You know what tzedakah means in Jewish life, in Jewish law. What is it? Why so much important? People say because Jews are good. I don't know whether Jews by nature are tender. I don't know. I have still questions. It's very simple. Since compassion in total involvement in the destiny of the Tao, at all levels, at intellectual level, at the emotional level, at the moral culpability, level of moral culpability, is the first aspect of the Am Covenant, this existential identification expresses itself in halakhic terms of tzedakah. I must extend assistance to my brother who is in need and cannot help himself. I must share the burden which unfriendly circumstances placed upon his frail shoulders and help him carry this burden. There is something very interesting about tzedakah, which I want you to understand. Basically, what's the equivalent in English? Not in English, it's in Latin. That's what it means. Love expressed in deeds. But basically this translation is very wrong. And I'll explain you why. This translation distorts the whole concept of tzedakah. Caritas in Latin is rather the equivalent for the Hebrew term of chesed. Chesed, you know, means loving kindness. This is basically, caritas is the equivalent, means loving kindness. It's almost, semantically, it's almost the most exact translation of loving kindness. While tzedakah, whoever knows Hebrew, tzedakah and tzedek are the same words, But what does tzedek mean in Hebrew? Justitia, justice. Righteousness. Why the hey was added is a different problem. What is tzedek and tzedakah the same? Why this noun was heavy, has the feminine form, it's a problem. It's a problem. My mind tries to solve this problem. But if it means it's justitia, it is justice, righteousness. Let us see, what's the difference between caritas, philosophically? What's the difference between caritas and justitia? They're both Latin terms, justitia and caritas. Or between charity, loving kindness, and righteousness, justice. There is one difference. Justitia is a juridic idea. It's a legalistic term. Caritas is not a legalistic term, not a juridic term. Caritas is a moral term. The law doesn't know anything about caritas. Even in courts of equity, there is no caritas. Equity is also based on justitia. But there are two kinds of justitia. The plain, simple justitia, you loan money, you have to pay. And there is equity, a higher form of justitia. But even courts of equity have nothing to do with caritas. A court cannot decree caritas, cannot tell me what to do. Because caritas itself, basically, means voluntary, free, non-uncommitted, self-imposed, flowing out of a free choice. Love, you can't compel one to give you love. You can compel him to live according to the law, but not to give you love. If he refuses to give love, it's no way to compel. Not even a husband can compel his wife. Not even a father can compel his children to give him love. So caritas is, of course, love is a moral value. Justice is not only a moral value, it's a juridic value. It's a juridic concept. You understand? The ethos, caritas is a question of the ethos. Justice is a concept of the law, of the law and order. If you'll take my monitors, just one moment, I want to. My monitors in the last chapter, I cannot read it completely, but it needs more. Chapter 65, last section, third section. He says, my monitors, not 65, excuse me, not 65, but 59. No, 53, part 3. He says, Chesed, denoting an excess. It is especially used of extraordinary kindness. Loving kindness to those who have no claim whatever upon us. This is my mind's definition. Third section, chapter 53. Who have no claim whatever upon us. Now, tzedek, the term tzedaka, derived from tzedek, means righteousness. He denotes the act of giving everyone his due and of showing kindness to every being according as he deserves. This is law. He always demands give the other fellow what is due to him. Morality demands from us give every fellow what is not, even what is not due to him. So now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, so the term tzedakah, if we translate it with caritas, what does it mean? What does it mean, gentlemen? Ladies and gentlemen, what does it mean? If it is caritas, then it means so. It's an act of loving kindness. You see, the man, for instance, it's interesting. The man, for instance, who gives tzedakah, what do you call bald tzedakah? What does it mean? Bald tzedakah means a man of justice. Correct. In English, what will you say? How will you say? You'll use the Greek equivalent of philanthrop. What does it mean? Philanthrop means a lover of people. It's love. You see, however you maneuver, then you want to express the idea of tzedakah in English, you take refuge, so to say, in the Greek Roman world view. They didn't know anything of charity. I mean, I'll use tzedakah. I should give him, I owe anything to the poor man, I don't owe him anything. The Greek, with their disdain, with their supercilious attitude toward the poor classes, With their disdainful approach, I owe him. I owe something to the slave. I don't owe anything. If I'm a philanthrop, a lover of people, it's a luxury, basically. Of course, I can be very generous. That's all. Very generous. Basically, if you study Greek history or Roman history, you wouldn't find a single incident of the stalker. They don't know anything. Zdaka was not enumerated among the virtues formulated by Plato and Aristotle. They don't know anything of Zdaka. Charity? No. All right, it's a luxury. One likes the arts and the sculpture. Not only one likes to play around with human beings and shower love upon them. For instance, because of that, no system of law in Western society has ever said that Dhaka, the charity, can be collected, compulsorily collected from people. That you can sit down, assess a man, his financial circumstances, fix an amount which he's supposed to give, must give, according to financial report, and collect the amount from him. I mean, if such a bill should be introduced in Congress, or in any legislature or general assembly, in any of the 48 states, people would say that the senator or the Congress or the member of the House who introduces such legislation that is not in his right senses. Because the basic idea of charity means freedom. Because it is not a juridic category, it's not a juridic norm. For instance, thou shalt not steal is a juridic norm, but thou shalt help the poor is not a juridic norm, gentlemen. This is a moral norm. Morality, what's the difference between law and morality? Law is enforceable, morality is inenforceable. You cannot enforce morality. Morality is the element of freedom. While the moral norm can be enforced, a man can be compelled to comply with the moral norm. Yeah, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt pay your debts, and so forth. This is exactly what is the Roman Greek concept. It was adopted by Western society.
Well, isn't this true?
It is.
I'm just wondering about in contemporary times, this whole struggle in the Supreme Court in terms of the desegregation, in some respects, reflects what I would think a kind of moral law as well as a legalistic law.
A legalistic law because the Constitution, as it was enacted, inequality is a constitutional term, so it becomes law. But now, the new concept of Dhaka, which is alien completely to any system of law adopted by civilized society, is different. The Jewish law says that Dhaka is a juridic term. And Dhaka, you know what it was? This is the law and this was the practice throughout the generations. There was assessment. Like now, there was assessment of taxes, there was assessment from Zdaka. Bedin, or whoever it is, the community or the court, used to sit down, appraise objectively the circumstances of a member of the community, assessing not only his taxes in regard to taxes, this was a different assessment, how much Zdaka he must give. What different it is, whatever it is. Whatever it is, self-government. Of course, if we have no self-government, we couldn't assess. Because in the Middle Ages we had self-government. In Babylonia we have self-government. But it goes back to the Second Commonwealth. As a matter of fact, we used to assess individuals. And the individual refused to pay. So they used simply take away his property, sell it. The method of foreclosure. And collect the amount which was fixed and raised upon this particular individual. And the famous statement in Baba Batra, which Maimonides quotes it in his famous chapters on Zdaka, Memashkinin ala Zdaka, you can sell property in order to collect Zdaka, which was assessed and fixed, with regard to one individual, Afilu Ba'avi Shabbatot, even on Friday afternoon, when all courts are closed. So you open the court for this session, for this particular act, you give an edict of collection, what do you call it, and you collect Zdaka. Why is it so? It's strange. Why is it so? Because Dhaka depends upon our experience, upon the existential community, the awareness of togetherness, which manifests itself in social responsibility, in sympathy, requiring a welfare action, is places a duty, not a moral duty, but a legalistic duty, a juridic duty. This is not an act of charity, of compliance, but an act of compliance with a legal duty enforceable by the courts. This goes back to the covenant in Egypt, am together. Basically, it means that our property rights are not parochial. They are community property rights. But otherwise, that the poor man has a right to my property, and if I refuse to give him his share, it's like, it is a violation in contravention of a juridic norm, of the law. Like, as if I had loaned money and refused to pay the creditor. This is basically the community of responsibilities. It finally results in a community of property. Of course, the community of property had to be, restricted, but this is basically private property is non-existent in Judaism. I'll come to it later. First of all Jews may share your property. Of course, the Jew needs. If there is no need, I must. And of course, sharing does not mean by unilateral action on the part of the poor should just come into the house and take away. It must be enforced. It must have, so to say, it must employ a legal procedure. But this legal procedure, a poor man can come, upon the law, it's a funny law. A poor man can come in the city and say, this man is rich, and I am starving. I want him to support. The court, with upon request, will assess possibilities, of course. Inquire, assess possibility whether the man can make a living, and the court should find out that this poor man cannot make a living, he's helpless. And he's the only one who can support him, there's no one else in the community, so court can write an edict of collection. And by writing an edict of collection, it means it becomes a debt. This is the Jewish law, it's halakha, this is not my philosophy, my experience. And this is based upon the covenant of Am, together at all levels, at the level of destiny, interests, feelings, experiences, moral responsibilities, and welfare responsibilities, and finally, together in property, in ownership. All right?